Hello, I'm Michaela Maguire, Artistic Director of Melbourne Writers Festival. You're listening to a conversation from our 2021 podcast series.
Hello, I'm Emma Alberici. Welcome to the Melbourne Writers Festival. I'd like to begin by acknowledging that I'm on Gadigal land and pay my respects to the people of the Eora Nation, elders past, present, and emerging. We are so honoured to be joined today by Jhumpa Lahiri, a celebrated author both in English and more recently in Italian, a language she didn't pick up until she was in her 40s. Jhumpa Lahiri has published two novels and two collections of short stories. Her most recent book of fiction is called Whereabouts, but in 2018, when she first wrote it, it was in the Italian language and called Dove Mi Trovo. Jhumpa Lahiri has been awarded the Pulitzer Prize for her very first piece of work, which was called The Interpreter of Maladies. And she's also been awarded the Humanitarian Medal, which was put around her neck by none other than Barack Obama. Jhumpa Lahiri, thank you so much for joining us from your home in Rome today.
Thank you so much. Thanks for having me.
I should also mention that your first novel was awarded a Pulitzer Prize, and in 2014 you were also handed an honour by Barack Obama, the Humanities Medal, which for Australians is, I understand, an acknowledgement of your work in helping Americans and the globe really understand the fabric of multiculturalism in America. So congratulations for all that you've achieved so far and all that you will no doubt achieve with this latest piece of work. Before we get into it, I hinted there that you have family across three continents. How is everyone faring through this pandemic? It would be remiss of me not to ask.
Well, it's been very intense to follow the pandemic in so many parts of the world, in India, in Italy, in the United States, in the United Kingdom, where we have many friends as well, and everybody has been struggling, and everyone has been, has faced loss, and so that's been. It's been very hard, and it also broadens the perspective and makes, at least makes me realize that, you know, it's not just about, you know, things getting better in any specific place, because, you know, if any part of the world is struggling with a pandemic, we are all struggling with the pandemic. That's quite
indeed
clear. So,
yeah. Indeed, we're in lockdown as we speak to you, and it's been constant not only here, but I know also obviously and acutely in Italy, where you're sitting right now, of course, was ground zero for Europe.
Yeah, I mean, it just keeps fluctuating, you know, and there doesn't seem to be any clear resolution, and they're just waves, as they say, right?
Yeah. You wrote this book in 2018 in Italian, but of course Italian is not your native language. You moved there, as I understand it, in 2012.
I did. Italian is not my native language. I don't know really what is my native language, you know. I've always had a complicated relationship to every language that I've known, and I felt both that it is one of my languages and not my language at the same time. And I felt that with Bengali, which was technically my first language, and then English, which then became my dominant language, and then with Italian, which arrived rather late. There are sort of these degrees of belonging and not belonging in each case with all three.
I might get you to read us a passage from the book, because I found reading it, particularly at this time, because you wrote it, as I mentioned, in 2018, and 3 years later you've translated it yourself into English, having first written it in Italian. And I want to talk to you about language, obviously, in greater detail, but perhaps for those watching, it would be instructive if perhaps we can hear you, if you wouldn't mind, for us reading a passage from the chapter In the Pool. And this is a book that takes us through a woman's journey. And I thought interesting for this particular moment in time, when we're talking about social distancing and connectedness, that this felt like a real story of our time, even though you wrote it 3 years ago. So I might just get you to, if you don't mind, give us the passage.
Yeah, okay. In the Pool. Twice a week at dinner time, I go to the pool. In that container of clear water, lacking life or current, I see the same people with whom, for whatever reason, I feel a connection. We see each other without ever planning to. They come at the same time, on those same days, to escape life's troubles. Here's the elderly woman who walks with a limp, leaning on a cane. The space is like an amphitheater, and it's hard for her to make it from the locker room to the edge of the pool. She uses the ladder to get in and always swims with her face above water. Next to her is the guy with the shaved head who dives deep and does laps for over an hour, never stopping. His potent somersaults send him down nearly half a length before he comes up again for air. It's an enormous pool, and the 8 lanes are almost always occupied. 8 different lives share that water at a time, never intersecting. I swim for about 40 minutes, maybe 50, before I get tired. I'm not a strong swimmer. I can't do a flip turn. I never learned how. The idea of being on my back underwater scares me a little. I typically do the crawl with a weak but decent stroke. In the pool, I lose myself. My thoughts merge and flow. Everything, my body, my heart, the universe, seems tolerable when I'm protected by water and nothing touches me. All I think about is the effort. Below my body, there's a restless play of dark and light projected onto the bottom of the pool that drifts away like smoke. I'm surrounded by an element that restores me, one in which my mother wouldn't know how to survive. She was the one who brought me to the pool when I was little. She'd wait for me. She'd watch me from above, seated on the bleachers, always slightly nervous as I learned to float and breathe and kick. Water can cover me without drowning me. My mother and I are different that way. Perhaps a few drops enter my nose or ears, but my body resists. And yet, every time I swim, I feel cleansed as if from within. It's just that in the locker room, when the other women chat among themselves, I'm prey to terrible stories, brutal information shared as they take their showers, take off their swimsuits, shave their legs and armpits and groins in awkward, contorted poses. That's how one day a young mother, responding to a woman who remarked, "I haven't seen you here lately," talked about her son's cancer, a little boy just 18 months old. He's already had 2 operations. She recounted trips to the best hospitals, the hellish treatment, the precarious recovery. A few days later, 2 women discussed the adult son of a 3rd woman they both knew. He'd had an accident while on vacation with his family. He'd slipped in such a way that now he was paralyzed and risked never walking again. "God, what a nightmare," one of the women said, before turning on the hairdryer and grooming herself. Today, a woman in her 80s who swims 4 days a week shares a memory that surprises us. She admits that she's afraid of the sea because of a huge wave that once knocked her down and twisted her up when she was a girl. "I was about to drown," she says, still stunned. "When I was tossed onto the shore, water was pouring out of my nose, my mouth, my ears. My arms were scraped from top to bottom." She'd been swimming with an aunt who, seeing her frightened, had held her hand. But that human anchor had only caused more harm. She'd have been better off nearly drowning on her own. It's hard to imagine her body when it was young. Over the years, it's lost its shape. She's hunched over, covered with moles. She gets dressed, combs her hair, and puts on a few gold rings, including her wedding band. In this humid, rusty place where women congregate, naked and wet, where they show each other the scars beside their breasts and on their bellies, the bruises on their thighs, the imperfections on their backs, they all talk about misfortune. They complain about husbands, children, aging parents. They confess things without feeling guilty. As I take in these losses, these tragedies, it occurs to me that the water in the pool isn't so clear after all. It reeks of grief, of heartache. It's contaminated. And after I get out, I'm saturated by a vague sense of dread. All that suffering doesn't leak out like the water that travels into my ear now and then. It burrows into my soul. It wedges into every nook of my body. The old woman closes her purse and politely says goodbye. But before leaving, as I'm drying my limbs, she says, "I've got a bunch of dresses in my closet that would look good on you. They're adorable, but I can't wear them anymore. Would you like them so they don't go to waste?" She adds without skipping a beat, "It's been decades since I've had a waist."
Thank you. When I read your book and I saw some other reviews, it talked about being lonely, but I read it differently, and perhaps because I read it at this time, I felt connected. I felt that she was connected, and I saw not loneliness. I saw the opposite of loneliness. I saw that she was very in touch with her community. How did you experience the writing of it? What were you intending with this?
I never know what I'm intending, but I was writing it as I was moving back and forth between the United States and Rome for a period of 2 years or so. I actually started writing it when I was still living in Rome in 2015. I sort of started it vaguely, not really knowing what it was going to become. But I was getting to know this character, getting to explore this woman and her environment, and then it became a larger sort of formal study of a woman in her environment, and then sort of understanding the different pieces of her environment, and that's how the book grew, and it was an interesting process because it was written, as I said, when I was always coming back to Rome. So I never wrote any of it when I was in the United States, even though technically in that period I was living more in the US and coming back to Italy sort of as an exception when I had time off. So I think the book has this sense of movement and moving literally from place to place. Perhaps because it was always written, you know, in that, with that sense of movement, I was always sort of bringing it back with me on the plane and traveling back and forth with this notebook that was slowly, you know, filling up with episodes about this woman.
So this also, it sounds to me, it was a little bit like you're getting to know, it was a book about you getting to know Italy and being excited about being reunited with her every time you returned. Was it a bit like that?
I think it was, I mean, I had already lived in Italy for 3 years, right, before I wrote the book. So it wasn't written in the phase of that initial exploration of my life here. No, it was written in a second phase when that life was already inside of me. You know, I mean, I think it's hard to write about things when you're first going through them. I mean, one can, but it's a different kind of impression that you're getting. So things had really sedimented inside of me quite a bit by the time I started writing these scenes.
I saw someone else describe it as life on the periphery. Mm-hmm. Is that how you would describe this book?
I mean, the character says at one point that she feels on the periphery, right? She says she doesn't feel at the center of things. And at the same time, she's very much at the center of things. She lives in a neighborhood. She's surrounded by people who recognize her, people she knows. She runs into people. So you know, yes and no. I mean, I think the book is full of sort of kind of contradictory tension, if you will. And so one of the things, I mean, as you say, partly it's about community and connection, and it's also about loneliness, because she is on her own in a certain respect. She's, you know, she lives alone. She doesn't have a family. She doesn't have a significant other in her life. So she does spend a lot of time on her own and reflecting. But she also spends a lot of time around other people and about, you know, the city and going in and out of different environments. So I think it's both, you know. I think it's both and. It's not an either or question for me.
I loved the chapter on solitude. Sorry, I was going to say I loved the chapter on solitude because it's very much what you describe as a tension, because her mother seems to be very uncomfortable in her own company, whereas the character who I'll repeat you don't give a name to, which we'll talk about that in a moment, but she seems completely at ease in, you know, being alone and being with her, you know, spending time with herself. In fact, when she bumps into her ex-boyfriend, it's hilarious that she sort of, you know, whoever she bumps into, I never got the sense she was desperate to stay with that person or in that moment, which is what you would think an exploration or examination of loneliness would evoke. But I never felt like that reading it.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, I think she's not entirely comfortable on her own either, you know. I mean, I think it's the way that I think so many of us have an ongoing relationship with solitude, which is both necessary for our own peace of mind, I think, our sense of self, our being comfortable with who we are, enabling us to be with other people, having positive relationships with other people. But I think one can also feel alone and isolated and need people, need contact, you know? So again, I think, I mean, it's she's both outside looking in, and she's also very much a player on the stage of her life. She's on her own, and sometimes she's very grateful for the sort of space and time that she governs. And other times I think she wonders what it would be like to have more sort of complicating factors in her life. You know, what if she had become a mother? What if she had, what if she were the wife of somebody, what have you? But I think that the key is that she's really having a dialogue with herself, you know, and I think that's what solitude is after in the end. I think it's whether or not you are able to create a relationship with yourself. And I think that's the only way that solitude really kind of flowers, if you will, and becomes something tangible and also sustaining. So I think that's, you know, I think that she's able to get to that point where her solitude is something that is sustaining, not just a lack, but also something that gives her, you know, sort of defines her in a way.
Well, I mean, I asked you to read that particular chapter in the pool because at the moment in Australia, with these constant snap lockdowns, we're experiencing the only reason we're allowed to go outside is to exercise. It's winter here, but a lot of people, because we are an island nation, a lot of people in the cities live very close to the coast and swim a lot. And so suddenly people are doing much more outdoor activity than perhaps they used to before. But you wrote this in 2018. Why? Why then? And as you mentioned, you'd already lived in Italy. You had already lived in Italy for quite some time. What was it at that moment in time that made it the right time to publish this book? Because it's only 157 pages. It's a lovely read. But in that regard, you could have written it at any time, presumably. Why did it take so long if you say you started it in 2015? And why did you decide to kind of put your pen down in 2018?
These are questions I can't answer for you, you know? I mean, I think books are born when they're born for whatever reason. I mean, I can't explain why my son was born in 2002 and my daughter was born in 2004. I mean, it just, writing is so mysterious and we're just, you know, I am following my inspiration. And so in that moment, this was the story that came to me. This was the character. This was the mood. These were the questions I was exploring. This was the tonality. This was the Italian, you know, this was the voice that came to me in that moment. And then I wrote the book, and then that moment passed, and I wrote another book, and then another book after that. So, you know, but I can't explain to you why I chose to write a book. It's not in response to anything, you know. I mean, I think it's not in response to anything that's tangible or logical or connected to real time or the passage of real time. I mean, writing is, you know, writing is responding to the unconscious, and it can go, you know, I can write a book tomorrow that responds to something that happened 45 years ago, or in the future for that matter, right? That hasn't even happened, a projection, speculation. So I can't explain why I wrote the book when I wrote it. There wasn't any design. You know, having said that, it did occur to me as I was translating it, that during the pandemic, it occurred to me that there was this sort of layer to the book that could feel resonant for our current, you know, situation with the pandemic and social distancing and, you know, feeling cut off from people, being cut off from people, having to spend more time sort of on our own or with very few people, not being able to move around a lot. You know, this is a character who, unlike me, has never lived anywhere other than the place where she was born and raised, right? So, but that's now the reality for many of us. We have to stay in our city or even our neighborhood, and there isn't the freedom to get up and move and cross borders as we're, you know, accustomed to doing. So I see how the English version of the book, you know, is in conversation with what's happening right now. But it wasn't. Of course, I couldn't. How could I have predicted it? I never imagined that it would have this extra layer of significance, if you will, in English. Because when it came out in Italian, it was, as I said, it was 2018. It was we didn't know what coronavirus was, and when it, you know, in its first incarnation, it was what it was. I mean, it was a portrait of this woman, and it was a kind of more, you know, a book about with a more kind of existential quality, if you will, thinking about living, you know, thinking about what makes a life, what goes into the inner life, things like that.
Why was it a personal challenge for you to write this book first in Italian? Because of course you could have written it in English. What were you trying to say to Italians? Because of course they were the ones who were going to have the pleasure of this book first.
I wasn't thinking about the book being read by anybody other than me. And that's always the case when I write something. I never think of other people reading it in the beginning at all. Writing for me is always a conversation I'm having with myself, right? And so in this case, I mean, I'd already written another book in Italian. So I had already sort of turned the corner into another language. I'd begun thinking in another language. I'd begun writing in another language. I'd written some stories in another language, in Italian, you know, so I had already written a fair amount in Italian. And so when I started exploring this character in these various sort of brief episodes, I was already well on this new path, if you will, which has continued. And so now it's been 9 years that I've been essentially writing, not exclusively, but for the most part, and certainly all of my creative work has been produced in Italian. So this book comes as a kind of, you know, the second phase. I mean, I think the first phase of my Italian writing culminated in the book In Other Words, which was a snapshot of that experience of coming to the language and what was driving me to learn Italian and what did it mean for me and so on and so forth. So I wrote that book to answer for myself certain questions about why I was being so drawn into another language. But by the time I wrote this book, I was thinking and speaking and writing in Italian every day. So it was just totally natural that I would write it in Italian. So I did, you know, and I was the reader. I was the one who was reading the book first and foremost. And then eventually other people read it, Italian readers who, you know, I mean, and when you think about who is an Italian reader, well, an Italian reader can be anybody. It doesn't have to be someone who is, you know, who's Italian per se, or carries an Italian passport, or comes from an Italian family. An Italian reader is anybody. I'm an Italian reader. My students at Princeton who come from all sorts of backgrounds who study Italian are all Italian readers. So, I mean, that's the thing about readership, right? It's just because it's written in a specific language doesn't mean it corresponds to a certain population in my mind. It's anybody who has the means or the desire or whatever, the familiarity with the language, who can access the book, right? So to think of it more broadly, that's important to keep in mind.
You translated the book yourself, and I get the feeling from especially the postscript about one of the words in particular that you wanted to dwell on a little longer, that you found or find something particularly enchanting about the language and the way it translates or doesn't to the English. Can you talk to us a little bit about some of the words, and perhaps tell us about the one on, I think it was page 77, that you mention it, you mention and kind of underline for us?
Yeah, well, I mean, that word, so the word is porta gioie, which means jewelry box in Italian. And so Italian is full of these compound words for to describe different kinds of containers. So portombrelli is an umbrella stand, or a porta grissini is a place where you put grissini, or a porta cenere for ashtrays, and so on and so forth. So porta gioie is a jewelry box, but what makes the word so beautiful and poetic is that gioia in the singular is also just the word for joy. So if you look at the word, it means jewelry box, but if you look at it, you know, if you peel back that that obvious definition, it means a carrier or a container of joy, which are things that I think only I, coming into the language from where I'm coming, which is from the outside, maybe would stop to think about, you know. And so that's what's that's what's so rich about being a foreigner, about coming into something that isn't quote unquote yours, right? Coming to learn something and discover something in a way that isn't just automatic. So coming from the outside, this perspective of coming, this foreign perspective, right? That I bring necessarily to Italian because it's a language that I don't grow up with. I don't know from my childhood. I don't know, you know, really until, I mean, I started studying it in my 20s or whatever, but, you know, I didn't really start speaking it well until my 40s. And then I didn't even ever live in Italy until I was 45 years old. So there was a whole, you know, there's a whole lifetime of not having this language inside of me. And then suddenly I realized the language actually was inside of me. But these kinds of words, these kinds of reflections come out of that position, right, of being both inside and outside of something. So when I first translated the book out of Italian, I actually skipped that entire sentence because I realized there was no way I could render it into English in a straightforward way because there's no equivalent, right? There's no equivalent to Porta Gioia in English. And so I just bypassed it, which was interesting. And it was only when I went back to the entire draft in English that I realized, oh, I've left out this bit about the Porta Gioia. What can I do about it? And it really took me, you know, like sort of half a day to figure out how to go about maintaining that reference in the book and what to do with it. And in the end, I decided to expand it and talk about it in the only note. I think it's one of the only notes, the only real note, explanatory note in the novel. And I thought it was worthwhile for someone who might be interested to know about this specific instance. But I think, yeah, go ahead.
I was going to say, even the original title, Dove Mi Trovo, is not really easily encapsulated in one word.
No, it's not. It's, I mean, the thought of it, the sentiment of it is not you know, easily convertible, right, into English. So it's you know, where I find myself isn't.
Did you agonize, you know, isn't about the English title? Sorry,
I actually didn't have an English title for a long time. It didn't have an English title until I was almost done with the translation, and then I chose a completely different, you know, I just chose a different path because, you know, the idea of trovarsi in Italian again is so, there's this poetry built into that reflexive verb, and so it's not just about finding oneself in space, you know, in a location sense, but finding oneself again in a more kind of existential, emotional sense. And that's something that you have in, you know, the first line of Dante's Inferno, which is why he uses that word, right? Why he uses that verb. So it's, you know, when he finds himself in that dark wood, it's not just that he happens to be in the dark wood. It's just, it's loaded with meaning that we cannot access coming from English. Right. So I thought that I would, I struggled to name the book actually for a very long time. And then whereabouts, came to me, as I said, in a very late stage, while I was flying back to Rome one time on the plane, just occurred to me that this might be the English word to capture the spirit and the mood of the book, because that was more important to me. And in any case, the title does convey, you know, a sense of place and the question of place, which is what Dove Mi Trovo also, in the end, also does, right? So,
when you moved to Italy, I saw that the FT in London kind of abbreviated your whole kind of life change as a move from the high-paced New York to the calm and cappuccino of Rome. Is that how you experienced the move to Italy?
No, not at all. I mean,
because you're living a pretty tranquil life. Just for the benefit. Sorry, I was going to say for the benefit of our audience, you moved to Rome as a mother, a wife, and a writer.
I did. I moved to, you know, boiling hot Rome in August of 2012. I had two small children. I had a husband who didn't speak Italian. You know, I was the only person who spoke Italian. And my Italian was very basic at that point. And it was a far more, it was a far more complicated life than my life in Brooklyn had been. Certainly. I mean, I had a very calm, life, on the whole in Brooklyn, living in my neighborhood next to a park, knowing, you know, how to do everything, how to get around, how to, you know, get on a bus and get off of it and where to go and where to shop and surrounded with friends and et cetera. I mean, we moved to Rome. We didn't know anybody. We had no friends in the whole city. And everything we built, right? We built slowly over time a new life here. But it was, I don't know. I think people just have such strange impressions of what life in New York means as opposed to what life in Rome means, you know? I mean, they're just these very broad stereotypes, I suppose, that don't correspond to reality. So, you know, so the answer is no. I mean, I think Rome is, certainly Rome is it's a smaller city than New York, right? It's a less kind of, it's less dynamic city than New York. It's less international city than New York. So there's a certain, you know, a different sense of pace and time, of course, here than in New York. So in that sense, I suppose, I don't know. I don't know. I don't really pay attention to these things because life is unique to each of us. You know, each person's experience of a place is very different, right? So I came to Rome and I knew very quickly that this was my city. This is where I felt, you know, at home more than any other place. And I wanted to be here and I wanted to build a life here. And I have so many friends who, you know, have a very different relationship to Rome. I have Roman friends who have very different relationships to Rome and or don't like to be in Rome and, you know, come back to Rome only because they have to visit their parents or whatever. So, you know, cities are like, they're like people, you know, they're, you have relationships with them and it doesn't always work for everybody. You know, I knew this from growing up in the United States. My father loves where my parents ended up living. My mother was always at odds with it and sort of suffered because she was an urban creature and she was, you know, always sort of eager for a different kind of life. More people, more variety, more noise, more color, more everything. So there you have it. You know, the places aren't neutral, you know, or we're not neutral rather. I mean, and we read into places and we create relationships with places. And then our relationships with places also change over time. You can love a place and then you can grow weary of a place. And then you can grow to reconnect with a place. It's all very, very subjective and very mysterious in a way why some people feel a pull towards certain places. But I certainly felt a pull with Rome that, and I've never felt that with any other city. I mean, I think, you know, I love the sea. So pretty much wherever I go, if there's the sea, I feel a sense of connection and a sense of, you know, a sense of kind of calm and happiness, which is good because there's a lot of ocean and sea in the world. But there was something about Rome in particular that spoke to me very clearly, very, very quickly. And it hasn't changed. It's only intensified.
Was there anything about Italy or Rome that you wanted to give to the Anglosphere by translating it into English? Because did you know from the start you were going to do this?
No, I didn't know. I didn't know who would translate it. I didn't know whether to translate it. I didn't know whether it would really work in English. So in the beginning, I wasn't thinking about it in English at all. And I mean, technically, we don't ever know that we're in any specific part of Italy. It's never mentioned. And there's actually just one or two clues that the character speaks Italian. And that's about it. So she could really be from anywhere as well, right? We know that she speaks Italian and she teaches it. But that's about it. She gives lessons to people. So people can kind of interpret her and her setting as they wish. I mean, some people who have read the book who live in my neighborhood recognize very specific things about the neighborhood, right? Some people who read the book who are Roman recognize the book as Roman. Some people who read the book who don't live in Rome and know nothing or very little about Rome don't necessarily connect the book with Rome at all. They connect it with some place in Italy, perhaps, or maybe not, or maybe we're in Spain, or maybe we're in France, or maybe we're in Czechoslovakia. I don't know, you know, because I purposefully left out so many of the obvious ways of locating and pinpointing a character in time and place. So to answer your question, no, I didn't have any intention when I brought the book into English. I just thought, well, let's see how it sounds in English. I was curious, and let's see what it would be like to translate myself out of Italian into English. I was curious to see how my voice would emerge back in English through the, you know, filtered through the Italian. I was curious about that. So that was really why I translated the book. It was really to satisfy a series of questions that I had about moving back and forth between the languages and working with the two languages and adding to my experience now, my growing experience as a translator out of Italian. So I think of it as a translation. You know, I don't think of it as a book that I conceived, because it isn't, right? In English, in any case. I think of it as something I'm reproducing. And I think of the person who wrote the book in Italian as another person in some sense. I had to sort of become two people, right?
You didn't give your character in Whereabouts a name. Was that deliberate?
Yes, it was. I mean, I think it just happens to be the case that in all of the stories I've been writing in Italian, for whatever reason, the characters are emerging without names. Sometimes I describe sort of who they are in relationship to other people. So maybe the husband or the daughter or something like that. So that's been something that's been a constant until now. I've written another book of in Italian of short stories, and in that book as well, the characters don't have names. And then I recently wrote this summer, a book came out also in Italian, which is essentially a book in verse, but with a kind of prose component. And in that book, there's a name. the author of the book has a name. Her name is Nerina. And that's the first time that I introduce a name in one of these Italian works. But I think that in exploring sort of writing characters without names is that then they can be, they're free to roam in the reader's imagination more than if you provide a name. And even if one has a name that, I mean, names are identifiers, right? Names are containers, names are ways to, you know, kind of pinpoint coordinates of people, depending on your last name, your first name, so forth. That means this person comes from a, you know, Italian family or, you know, Japanese family or whatever. So I just wanted to get out of that whole conversation. I just wanted to get out of it. And that's where I've been in these past years is exploring characters without specific identity markers, if you will. I'm trying to get at something else, I suppose, about them, peeling away sort of, you know, where are they from exactly and what kind of family are they from exactly? Because I think identity is such a complex issue, and there are so many of us who fall outside of, neat categories of identity. Identity is actually an incredibly messy thing, you know, and wonderfully messy, complex thing. So, but it can also, I think, be very confining. And so I'm, so I think for all of these reasons, that's why in this current phase of exploration as a writer, names are not what are interesting to me, which is interesting because I wrote an entire novel about someone who was, you know, struggling with his name and renaming himself and so on.
And also it evoked for me a bit of Elena Ferrante, because her whole name and identity is so mysterious. Mm. And she being another writer in Italian and in English, well, she doesn't translate her own. We don't assume her translator is related to her in any way, but it's that whole thing again about identity that I thought was really interesting, that you've chosen not to identify her particularly, just added another layer of intrigue for me as I was reading the book. I'd like to pivot our conversation ever so slightly to politics, if I may, because in Australia, as everywhere else in the world, this pandemic has raised so many questions about identity and fitting in, which is very much in the theme of your work. And what I mean by that is the border closures. In this country, it's about whether you belong to one state or another, and people are holding very firm to the rules that are being enacted accordingly. But of course, it's a much wider conversation about whether we open borders to the rest of the world and how we feel about our relationships with different countries and, probably more importantly, different cultures. I'm wondering, as someone who was born in London to Indian parents, who then migrated as a family to America. Now you're in Italy and have been there for the better part of 9 years. Whether you believe you are seeing Rome being more tolerant than, say, New York, or less so, more tolerant or less so than London? Or is that not something that you've been thinking about?
Well, I always think about issues of questions of tolerance, and, you know, I've never lived in a place where I felt completely accepted, and that's just the truth, because there is no such place, at least for me. I mean, even if I go to India, to Calcutta, I'm regarded as someone who comes from the outside, because I do, right? And that's been my case in my childhood in the United States. I never felt comfortable or at ease in the United States. for the formative years, right? Very acutely aware that my parents came from a very, very different and distant place, and that we weren't part of the sort of mainstream, if you will, of how people thought, lived, ate, dressed, and talked, and so forth. I remember visiting the United Kingdom, living there briefly as a child as well, going there on visits and being very aware of tensions and layers of intolerance. And then, of course, in Italy, it's always on my mind because Italy is a country that has recently begun sort of dealing with immigration from different parts of the world. And there's a lot of politics, and there's a lot of tension, and there's a lot of growth at the same time that comes from any given moment of movement and migration in any place, right? So again, I mean, if you ask me, do I think this place is more tolerant than that place as opposed to the third place? I can't say, because I can say to you, you know, that I've experienced, in some sense, you know, that idea or that reality of feeling outside and not welcome in every place I've been, you know, in every place I've ever been, or I've been aware of it in any case. And so there are just degrees of it, or it's declined in a different way in depending on where you are. You know, I mean, we actually, when we left America, I remember watching Obama's second election in Rome. So we actually left we were here for his second term, for Obama's second term. And it was only when we went back to the United States, that was when Trump was elected. So the timing was really bad because we missed the Obama second term, and then we had, you know, Trump's entire presidency in the United States, and then the Italian government has been in constant flux ever since we've been here, and the Indian government has been also you know, very problematic from my point of view, as has the government in the United Kingdom. So, you know, Brexit has happened since I was here. You know, that's completely changed sort of how so many people can live here. I'm no longer a European citizen. I was a European citizen until last January. I could come in with my UK passport and live as a European. I can no longer do that. So lots of things have happened, you know, in the past 9 years across the world. I mean, really, if I think about 2012, and I mean, it seems sort of almost before the fall, you know. I mean, there was no coronavirus. Trump had not been president, was not on the horizon of becoming president, at least from my point of view. You know, he was safely tucked back there somewhere.
Because I recall,
you know,
sorry to interrupt you, but I remember 2015, 2016 so vividly, because Frank Bruni in the New York Times wrote that seminal headline calling it Trumposcone. Mm-hmm. And it resonated for me as someone who'd been following Italian politics for so long,
right,
that there was an incredible similarity in the sort of brash businessman kind of bravado, mm-hmm, that, mm-hmm, seemed to be occupying, mm-hmm, the White House. It felt familiar.
Yeah. I mean, Berlusconi, in the end, I mean, compared to Trump, he seems entertaining, you know, which he was, in, you know, in many respects. He was also a very powerful man, but Trump's influence has been so much more dangerous for the world. You know, I mean, that's clear. I mean, yes, there are lots of similarities, absolutely, sort of strange similarities. unsettling similarities. But in the end, Berlusconi was, you know, his domain was, you know, relatively limited, right? And Trump has spawned a whole other kind of, you know, sort of larger tide, right? Whether you think of Brazil, whether you think of the United Kingdom, India, you know, the right in Europe, etc. I mean, all of this is part of a spectrum, I feel. Berlusconi didn't have
influence. Do you think the Trump presidency has emboldened the right throughout Europe?
Yes, I do. I do. I think it did. I think it absolutely did. Mm-hmm. Mm. It emboldened people in the United States to feel what they, you know, maybe thought they had to keep to themselves, and suddenly they weren't anymore, you know?
Does it feel like a less safe place to go back to now as a result of that when you head home to the US?
Again, I don't think of it as my home. And, you know, fully, I think of my home as sort of now between these two places. I don't know where it is, really. I mean, maybe it's in the airplane, you know, maybe it's nowhere. Maybe it's anywhere. But I don't have that kind of specific relationship to the United States. I never have, really. I never have, because my parents never thought of it as home for so long. So it's very hard for a child to feel at home in a place where your parents don't feel that it's their, they don't call it home. And that was my experience. And so, and then when I would go to the place that they did think was home, which was Calcutta, it was so clearly not my home, you know? So I was always, you know, I was always sort of reading home as not home, right? Or experiencing not home. So sense of, you know, so that's always been the case for me. But I feel at home. I think home is more of a feeling, right? A feeling for me. It's not connected to a place. It's not connected to a passport. It's not connected to a, you know, I can say in my life I've lived in X, Y, and Z places, right? I've had homes, I've dwelled in places, in these places. But I think in the end, home for me is a much more kind of fluid idea. And it really is, at this point, it's sort of, where am I with my family? Where are my books? Where are the books I need for whatever I'm doing? Right now, that's in Rome, and I'm feeling very, very at home here at the moment. In a few months, I'll be back in the United States teaching, and where I have a home and friends and things to do, and I'll, you know, feel at home there as well. But there's no one place anymore. But as I said, there really never was. There was always another side to these words, like home, especially.
I'm acutely aware that we've taken up so much of your time and you've been so generous. Thank you. But before I let you go, if you don't mind me asking one last question, and it's very specifically related to the time Australia is living through, and that is extreme. I mean, it's unsettling throughout the world, of course, but our government has gone for a bit of an eradication strategy, which isn't going all that well, and so are scared and living very much in their homes and isolating a lot. So if someone were to decide this is the moment in this place that they want to pick up a pen or a typewriter and start to write with a view perhaps of having something published, what is the single sort of best piece of advice you could give someone who was doing that for the first time or thinking about doing that but too nervous to approach it?
Well, I would maybe suggest that person develop a very healthy relationship with oneself, as I was saying, you know, writing as a form of and of investigation, inner exploration and investigation. And so to do that, one has to develop that dialogue, if you will. And I think if that's there, my sense is that the writing just sort of is a consequence of that inner life that is activated, right? I don't know. I mean, writing is about asking questions of yourself, of the world, of others. So if you have questions, explore them and see where they go on the page.
There was one other question I forgot to ask you that I know our audience would love me to, I'm sure. You've got children, like so many of us who are your fans, who are now teenagers. And I'm wondering, do you have the same struggles that the rest of us have in trying to encourage them to read?
Fortunately, no. My children are both very, they've always been very good readers, very passionate readers. They always had books with them wherever we went. They went to a Steiner school when they were young. So all sort of electronics and things were forbidden, really. So they didn't grow up in their first, you know, sort of formative years. They didn't have phones and tablets and things like that. They were still kind of new-ish when they were young, but they were sort of on the other end of the spectrum. And there was a lot more focus on sort of crafts and manual dexterity and drawing and penmanship, believe it or not, things like that. Now, of course, they're older, they both have iPhones, they have computers and the whole thing. But they were always readers. And I think that that's, if there's one thing that I'm very proud of as a parent, is that they both feel at home, on the topic of where is home. I think, you know, with the book in their hands, they feel somehow grounded and in place. And that's a gift. And I hope that stays with them, but I think it will. I think they're old enough so that they're always going to be readers.
Jhumpa Lahiri, we have been so honoured to have you at the Melbourne Writers Festival. I thank you so much for spending all this time with us, and I will just tell our audience that they can purchase your book through the Festival Partners Readings, which is an online bookstore as well as a physical one in Melbourne. So please do yourselves a favour, especially now when there is so much more time to be sitting down at home reading. Grab yourself a copy of Jhumpa's latest book, Whereabouts. And thank you so much again for being with us. Jhumpa Lahiri, thank you.
Thank you, Emma. It was a pleasure.
Thanks for listening. To support Melbourne Writers Festival, you can make a donation of any size at mwf.com.au.